The other day, I got a prayer letter from a man who's been sending me his prayer letter two or three times a year since we got out of seminary. This man stands out in my mind as one of the most wonderful examples of somebody who follows Jesus' lead in his life most faithfully. And yet he also stands out in my mind as somebody whose life has been filled with more suffering and stress as a result of following Jesus than I can hardly imagine. It didn't need to be that way for him. His father was renowned in his denomination as kind of a spiritual leader, a kind of an example of faith and so forth. And as a result, my friend was offered a position high up in the workings of that denomination as soon as he left seminary. They really courted him for that. And yet he felt that Jesus was saying, stay in the city that you are and plant a church in a neighborhood that will be really tough to get a church started because it's hostile to my message. And so he did that. He could have been a pastor in any number of eager churches in his denomination, but instead he chose to start a fledgling, struggling church plant, kind of like Open Door struggles, only the struggle in this case is slightly different because of the hostility to the message. And as a result, his prayer letters have been filled with the struggles, struggles that every church faces, you know, contentiousness, lack of giving, lack of leadership, people leaving and breaking your heart, these kinds of things. But it's so much more tough in a church that is a church plant that is struggling for every single week to make things work. And on top of that, he was asked to serve on the Doctrinal Oversight Committee for his denomination. And to his dismay, he saw over the years this denomination start to turn towards heresy and legalism. And he became a lonely voice, writing papers and arguing publicly at their conventions every year for the gospel of grace. And it really stressed him out. And I think that the combined burdens of those two things would have been okay as he leaned on his wife and his daughter and had a strong family. But then his daughter, as she approached teenage years, began to exhibit some of the troubling behaviors that so many of us have experienced in our families. And then they went beyond that, way, way beyond that, so that his daughter, once a loving, believing young woman, began to worship Satan openly and reject Jesus openly and hang out with drug dealers and deal drugs herself and hang out with violent people. And she was imprisoned more frequently. And she got pregnant and abandoned the baby into the care of her parents. And all of these things were just getting overwhelming to my friend. And then his father, the great spiritual leader, was unable to care for himself. And an act of charity that he had extended to some people he did not know years and years ago was turned against him. And now he's facing a lawsuit which threatens to, his home would be sold to pay it off and his retirement funds would be bankrupted. And his mother was no help because she had Alzheimer's and was needing help herself. And all of these combined things made it so that when I got these prayer letters, I was almost reluctant to read them. As much as I loved this man, and I would open them up and I'd start to see the same litany of stress and suffering and struggle because he was following Jesus. And when I read this letter, he said, I have discovered the need in my own life to pray that God would show me how to walk by faith. I thought, if there's one man in this world that walks by faith, this is the man. And yet he feels the need to pray this, what he calls dangerous prayer, that God would show me how to walk by faith. And he's been discovering, he said, he quoted Jeremiah, who wrote Great Is Thy Faithfulness, that's been turned in that great hymn. He said he's discovered that his destiny has nothing to do with the strength of his faith, but it has everything to do with the strength of God's faithfulness. And at that point, in reading his letter, I put it down. I said, God, why? Why don't you let up? This man has been following you. He's been faithful doing what you showed him to do. Why don't you heal his daughter? Why don't you build his church? Why don't you protect his father? Why don't you give him an ally in the denomination to stand for the gospel of grace? Why, Lord? I know that almost everybody in this room can relate at one level or another to that kind of a question. And in the Bible, there is a short episode that's described where Jesus deliberately takes his disciples into a problem. Because they have followed him, they are confronted with a problem that they cannot solve. But he did it to teach them, I'm convinced, about facing problems because you are following Jesus. In every gospel, this one episode, which includes a miracle of Jesus, is recorded. There's only one other miracle of Jesus that's recorded in every single other gospel, and that's the resurrection. And it's combined with another similar episode in three out of the four gospels. And this morning, what I'd like to do is read through these two little episodes and then discuss what lessons there are as we face the kinds of problems that cause us to ask why. Starting in verse 1 of chapter 6. Sometime after this, Jesus crossed to the far shore of the Sea of Galilee, that is, the Sea of Tiberias. And a great crowd of people followed him because they saw the miraculous signs he had performed on the sick. And then Jesus went up on a mountainside and sat down with his disciples. The Jewish Passover feast was near. When Jesus looked up and saw a great crowd coming toward him, he said to Philip, "Where shall we buy bread for these people to eat?" He asked this only to test him, for he already had in mind what he was going to do. Philip answered him, 8 months' wages would not buy enough bread for each one to have a bite." Another of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, spoke up, "Here is a boy with 5 small barley loaves and 2 small fish, but how far will they go among so many?" Jesus said, "Have the people sit down." There was plenty of grass in that place, and the men sat down, about 5,000 of them. And Jesus then took the loaves, gave thanks, and distributed to those who were seated as much as they wanted. He did the same with the fish. And when they had all had enough to eat, he said to his disciples, "Gather the pieces that are left over. Let nothing be wasted." So they gathered them and filled 12 baskets with the pieces of the 5 barley loaves left over by those who had eaten. After the people saw the miraculous sign that Jesus did, they began to say, "Surely this is the prophet who is to come into the world." And Jesus, knowing that they intended to come and make him king by force, withdrew again to a mountain by himself. When evening came, his disciples went down to the lake, where they got into a boat and set off across the lake for Capernaum. By now it was dark, and Jesus had not yet joined them. A strong wind was blowing, and the waters grew rough. When they rowed 3 or 3.5 miles, they saw Jesus approaching the boat, walking on the water, and they were terrified. But he said to them, "It is I. Don't be afraid." Then they were willing to take him into the boat, and immediately the boat reached the shore where they were heading. But I want to jump right to the chase. What is Jesus up to? Why is he doing this? Well, if we were there, if we were one of the disciples, what kind of questions would we be asking? And I know the question I'd be asking is, "Jesus, couldn't you have planned this a little better? You know, what are we doing way out here in the boonies? And now that we're out here and all these people show up, now you raise the question of food. If we had stayed on the other side of the lake, we'd have had no problem. Everything was going fine. We had plenty of people coming. The people were getting healed. The preaching was going on. All we would have had to do at any one point is say, you know, we're going to take a short break, go home and get something to eat. Come back at 7:30. We'll start again. and there'd been no problem. Why did you take us clear off to the other side of the lake? Now, there's some commentators that want to make the point that Jesus was escaping from the wrath of Herod, who had just killed John the Baptist. And so he was kind of exiled into the other side of the lake where Herod did not have jurisdiction. If that is true, it was a rather short exile because he came back the next day. So I kind of discount that. I don't think that that's the case. Some of the Gospels say that he did it to find rest and relaxation because they were so busy they couldn't even eat themselves. So they got in the boat and went over where they could kind of have a little retreat. Well, Jesus knew all those people were going to come. It was only just, you know, short distance around the other side of the lake. I believe that Jesus set up that circumstance where there was no food in sight deliberately because he wanted to teach these disciples something about what you do in the face of problems that occur because you have followed Jesus. And I believe that the first lesson that we must understand about this is in verse 6, where he says, he asked Philip, where are we going to find bread for all these people to eat? He asked that only to test him. And he already knew what he was going to do. Some of you are tested financially. Some of you are tested with health. Some of you are tested with strife in your relationships with your friends or coworkers. Some of you are tested in your career. Some of you are tested in your family. Some of you are tested emotionally or physically. If you're facing a test, a problem, because you have been faithfully following Jesus Christ, know this. It's a test. And he already knows what he is going to do. It's a test. There's a reason why people are tested. You cannot do this kind of testing in a classroom. You know, there's a point at which you've got to put the books aside, confront people with the problem, and say, what do you do? There's a reason why if you're in basic training, one day after they've told you to keep your head down, they're going to take you out and you're going to crawl on your belly under the barbed wire with live bullets flying overhead. There's a reason for that. There's a reason why if you're in the SWAT team training, eventually you will wind up charging through a door of a house that's been set up to simulate real conditions and with real flashbangs going off so that you can be confronted with the real situation and see how you operate. There's a reason why people are tested to see how they're going to respond. And in the same way, Jesus set up this laboratory environment out there in the boonies. He wanted to see how they would respond because he wanted to teach them about how to respond. And he turns to Philip and he says, Philip, where are we going to find the bread for all these people? Where are we going to buy it? Now, why did he turn to Philip? Well, the answer to that is fairly easy. Philip lived nearby as a child. He grew up in the town of Bethsaida, which is just down the road a few miles. And so Philip, you know, he's just, you know, he kind of keeps a low profile in the gospel, doesn't he? You know, he's just kind of there. And all of a sudden, Jesus is in his face. Okay, Philip, you're on. Where are we going to find the bread? And he's going, oh, let's see. There's the deli on Main. There's the bakery down by the... Wait a minute. Where are we going to get the money for this? Look at these people, and there's 5,000 men, so maybe the crowd is 15, perhaps even 20,000 strong. And Philip's going, it would take 8 months' wages, and we'd still only have enough for a bite for each person. This is impossible. We don't have enough money. That's his response. But contrasted with that in the text is a different response. It's Andrew and his new little friend who's brought his lunch. And he comes and he says, well, here's something. It's not loaves of bread, it's little cakes. And it's not huge fish, it's little fish like sardines. And he says, here is what we have. What's next? You see that? Here are the resources that we have to offer to you to help with your problem. You see that? And we also offer ourselves, what would you like us to do next? That second part may be a stretch. It's where he says, how can so little go so far? He's asking, what would you like me to do? It's kind of the tone of voice of the Old Testament King Jehoshaphat, who says, Lord, we don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. Philip says, this is impossible. We don't have enough money. Andrew says, may I please help you with your problem? Here is everything that I have to work with, and here is myself as well. And it's Andrew's response that gets things moving. Philip's response is a dead end. Nothing happens. Andrew's response opens up the possibilities, and things start to happen. When we are following Jesus, and he confronts us with a problem that is insurmountable, it's a test. He's looking for the response that says, Lord, here is what I have to work with. Here are my resources. And here is my life. May I please help you with your problem? It's important we understand the difference there. When we're facing problems, how often do we pray, Lord, help me with my problem? That's not the right response. The response he's looking for is, Lord, here am I. Here are my resources. How can I help you with your problem? It feels like your problem, but it's his problem because you're following him and he put you in that circumstance. Am I right? You see that? So the first thing we need to understand is this is a test. The second thing we need to understand is there's a response to the test he's looking for, and that is to surrender to him with our resources, our life, our energy, our attitude, and say, here it is. Now, you know that. We sing, trust and obey. There's no other way to be happy in Jesus, to trust and obey. I surrender all. We sing that, but how do you do it? How do we really, that's the tricky part, isn't it? And how do you know you're doing it? Because I don't know if you're like me, but I've got this habit. Every once in a while I find myself thinking that I'm following Jesus' lead in something and hedging my bets with my own little strategy on the side. Yeah, I'm going to follow Jesus, but I've got this thing in my hip pocket that I'll turn to if he doesn't come through for me. Right? How can you tell when Jesus is in control? I think we see it in this passage. First thing you can tell when Jesus is in control, our prayer language changes. We talked about that. Instead of help me with my problem, it's how may I help you with your problem? Okay. Second thing is we see an attitude or an atmosphere of peace. Jesus says to them, have the people sit down. And he's using banquet language there. It's like the host where all the dinner guests have gathered and now the time is to sit at the table. He says, have the people sit down. And you can see that, you know, the peacefulness of this in some of the other gospel accounts. It says they're grouped in 50s and they've got it kind of organized. And when the people sit down to be served, it just layers the thing with peace. Contrast this with what happens when the food trucks show up for the tsunami victims. You know, they get mobbed with all these people pushing and shoving and fighting and they're frantically throwing provisions over the side and then they bolt so they don't take the tires too. When Jesus is in control, the whole process is layered with a sense of peace. Now, there may be crisis situations going on. There was in this case. But it is peaceful as you go through it. If we're in charge, we're going to see stress. We're going to see strife. We're going to see trouble. We're going to see burnout. We're going to see arguing. We're going to see all this kind of stuff. If Jesus is in charge, you're going to see, have the people sit down. Peace. Okay? And then the other thing that we see here is if Jesus is in charge, you're going to see a glimpse of God's perfect ability to provide. Because Jesus takes what is freely offered, in this case this lunch, and he multiplies it to make it perfect for the circumstance, for what he knows we need. This is not, if you've heard this preached as a lesson in let's everybody please share your lunch, that's not what's going on here. I've heard somebody say, well, you know, this is, oh, well, this kid dared to share his. Well, I got a little something here and I can pass it. That's not what's going on here. If that was what was going on here, the last verses don't make any sense, where the people were going to rise up and make Jesus the king because they thought he was the prophet because of this miracle that he did. If they'd shared their lunch, they would have reacted almost opposite of that. Right? You don't want to make somebody king who's making you feel guilty all the time, making you do what you don't want to do. No, he multiplied what was offered to make it perfect. And we see it's perfect because it wasn't merely the bite that Philip had imagined they could buy with 8 months' wages. It was everybody had as much as they wanted to eat. And there was some left over. And they collected it and it filled 12 baskets, which was a Hebrew symbolic way to say perfect. When you're following Jesus and he leads you into the dead end valley of some huge problem, whether it's a physical problem, a financial problem, emotional problem, a decision problem, whatever it is, it's a test. And the response that he is looking for is not, Lord, help me with my problem. It's, Lord, how may I help you? Here are my resources. Here's my life. How can I help you with your problem? And when you take that attitude, you can tell you're really taking it, because the problem will be endured or fixed with peace. And you will see glimpses here and there, little winking evidences that God is on the case, because you'll see perfection revealed. And there's examples of this all over the place. My favorite example of this in this congregation is a story that I've told several times before. I'm going to tell it again because I believe we as a congregation need to tell this and retell it so that we remember it. There was a time in this congregation where everything was in austerity mode, where we had the attitude that we can't, because we don't have enough. We took Philip's attitude. We cannot do that ministry because we don't have enough money in the bank. And every month, the mortgage on this particular building, this room right here, was eating us alive to the tune of $1,000. Every month, we were getting further and further and further behind on that mortgage, plus interest. And every month, it was all this knuckle-wringing of, oh, well, let's see, we're going to pay the light bill, so we can't pay the water bill, but, you know, we can't, you know, and it was can't. Everybody be careful. Everybody, you know, we're poor. And then one day, God confronted us and said, why don't you try acting as though I'm not poor? Well, what should we do? Well, pass the plate and see what I will do. And this congregation is roughly half the size of this congregation now. Without any warning, without any preparation, without any notice, without any hype, said, okay, we're going to pass the plate this morning. We're $20,000 behind on the mortgage, and it's growing fast. That's, you know, plus the $400,000 that we owed on it. There's $20,000. We're going to pass the plate this morning. You put in a pledge of what you can pay in the next 2 weeks, over and above your regular giving. If you can't pay anything, just put zero on the piece of paper. No names, just put it in the plate and we'll count it up. And friends, when we counted that offering, $20,000 came in. Nah, don't clap or I'll pass the plate again. $20,000 came in. We went into the black. And our attitude changed. There was this optimism. Wait a minute. We may feel poor, but God isn't poor. Look at his resources. And we started to dream about ministry, and things started to change. And within a few years' time, we were thinking, you know what? God wants to blow out the walls of this place. He wants us to build this wing down here. And we don't know how we're going to do that if we've got this mortgage here. Let's see if we can get ready for that by paying off this mortgage here. Oh, no, well, that, you know, that's insurmountable. $400,000, 150, well, you know, there's, well, maybe in 3 years, if we really prayed and sacrificed, maybe we could pay most of it in 3 years. 2.5 years later, the final check was written on the mortgage for this room. And when we checked the records, that last check was written exactly 7 years within 1 or 2 days' time of that first offering. The response he's looking for is, here is our resources, here are our lives, how can we help you with your problem? And when that attitude is taken, when that response is made, the problem is resolved with peace. It may not go away, but it's endured or resolved with peace. And you see evidence that God is dealing with it with perfection. Those are the lessons, I believe, in this little lab experiment that Jesus did. Now, got some homework. There's two of these labs. And the second one has different details, but I believe the same lessons, where he sends the apostles rowing back across the lake that night. Go back. You know, what is it, Jesus? Which side of this lake do you want to be on? And they're going upwind. Here's the homework. Read through that. Read it in the other different Gospels, if you will. And look and see if you can spot the same lessons. Okay? The lessons of how you're going to respond. Where's the peace? Where's the perfection? Okay? And there's going to be a test. I'm not going to give you the test. Jesus is going to give you the test. When I did read down through the bottom of my friend's prayer letter, the whole tone of the thing changed. He had started out by explaining there were plenty of opportunities for him to be tested on walking by faith because the deficit in his little congregation that struggles perennially was greater that summer than it had ever been. You know, they were so far in the red. The lawyers were coming after his dad, and it looked like he would lose his house. His daughter was in prison and would not speak to the parents. And in a period of 2 months, God reversed every one of those. They're now operating in the black. The lawyers have backed off on his dad's lawsuit. His daughter has come back to faith in Jesus Christ, is wanting to reestablish her relationship with her parents and with her son, and is expected to be released into a halfway house soon. Now, how God did that is not the issue. It's no big deal. That's not, you know, how did he multiply those? Who cares? That he did is the issue. And then my friend understood, look, this is a test. His test lasted, you know, 12, 15 years. I don't know how long your test is going to last. But I know that the response that Jesus is looking for. And I know that when you are truly responding in that way, you will go through this test with peace. And all around you, you will see signs that God is providing perfectly what you really need. God bless you. God bless you.